Welcome to Nature Revisited, the podcast. For those of you who are new to the podcast, my name is Stefan Van Norden. And on this episode, Nature Revisited is honored to be featuring Greg Sarris, the author of the new book, The Forgetters. Greg Sarris is a storyteller and an author and a dreamer. He is also serving his 16th consecutive elected term as chairman of the Federated Indians of Graydon Rancheria. His many writings include How a Mountain Was Made, Becoming Story, and Grand Avenue, which was an HBO original series produced by Robert Redford. Greg joins me today from his home on Sonoma Mountain to talk about the importance of story and how story helps us to remember and not to forget. So, Greg, thank you for joining me today on Nature Revisited. It's an honor to have you on the podcast.
Good morning, and I'm honored to be here. And thank you for caring about nature and all the things that we need to be caring about these days.
Your life has certainly been a very interesting journey, both personally and professionally. You are an accomplished writer and the chairman of the Federated Indians of Graydon Rancheria. In this time of environmental chaos, I believe what is needed most is for people to have a personal relationship with nature. So today, I would like to focus more on your personal life and your new book, The Forgetters. Let's start with the fact that you were adopted as a child, and you were raised, as you say, thinking you were Mexican. What guided you to learning that you were, in fact, a Native American?
Let me start with my being adopted. I was adopted by a non-Indian family who thought they couldn't have children, and of course, then the typical thing happened. By the time they got me home, after 7 years of trying to have a child, they were 2 months pregnant with their own. Then they had two more after that. The first memory I have as a child was we were playing under an apple tree and somebody used the word adopted. So I asked my mother what that meant, and she told me some story about how both my parents had died in a car accident, and I felt that even at 4 years older, however old I was, that was a quote-unquote story. Later on, I asked more about my heritage. She first said I was German on the mother's side, or Irish and German, or something like that. And that's all she said. But then later on, I pursued it in my early teens. I was able to unearth my original birth certificate. For father, it had unknown non-white and had all the information about my birth mother. But for father, it had unknown non-white. And then if you read the narrative, it says father was likely Mexican or Spanish. I just thought, oh, okay, I'm Mexican. But by that time, I'd already had trouble in the family and was a pretty troubled youth. And so I found myself, even though I'd grown up in this white family, running with a lot of Mexican and American Indian kids, in a lot of Mexican and Indian families, in fact, living off and on with them. It wasn't a big thing to be Indian or Mexican. I just thought I was one of them or partly or something. Much later on, I found out that he was, in fact, American Indian, half American Indian, half Filipino. But by that time, I'd already established a relationship with Mabel McKay, Pomo medicine woman, a basket weaver, who was such an influence on my life. And, you know, you suddenly have this thing that you are, wow, I am a member of the group. But Mabel said something to me when I told her. She said, you're never going to be anything more than your experience or your story. Your ethnicity, Stefan, it does not presuppose point of view. Let's just be very clear about that. It has to do with experience. My experience was basically that of an outsider, an adopted child, always reaching or searching how to belong. A lot of that experience, as it turned out, had to do with the American Indian experience that I was related to. That kind of is how it started. Being a loner as a child, I was out in nature a lot. I spent a lot of time alone as a child in and around animals. It all just had a lot to do with the formation of who I am today.
So when did you first discover the idea of story and first start writing them down?
Another good question. Stefan, I didn't read a book until the 11th grade. Got a job as a busboy one summer and decided, oh my gosh, if I don't change my ways, this is going to be the end of the road for me, like it was for a lot of my friends' parents. So I began to study, and I wanted to be a businessman or have money or something. It is so hard to all of a sudden have to start reading and be alone with a light bulb in a room and away from friends and people on the street. I began learning to read a book and read, and I fell in love with literature and stories because it reminded me of what I heard growing up on the streets. Old people telling stories. Because I was adopted and an outsider, I was always listening and listening to the older people because I wanted to see how and where I might belong. The love and, I will say, need for story that I heard on the streets influenced my love of reading stories and then ultimately wanting to write them. That then connected me to the whole idea that I came to understand that as a species, as people, that's the only thing we have that really makes us human, which is language and stories. We can't fly or soar like an eagle. We can't run as fast as the bear. The only thing we have is stories. Living is the story. And we become, as we're in nature, ongoing. It's all interconnected, and we are part of it. And much of my writing has been about my dialogue with the world around me that I textualize on paper.
Who was Mabel McKay, and what role did she really play in your life?
I knew her adopted son, Marshall McKay, in junior high school, and I believe I followed him home one day, I remember, and I got to know her a little bit, and I just thought she was Marshall's mother. Now, I'd been around a lot of other Indian people, older people who had uncles or grandmothers or older people in the house. I heard a lot of Indian stories, and I saw things, I witnessed things that not in the reality of the world that most of us spend most of our time in. People were saying, oh, she's a medicine woman, and she can do this and do that. And I knew she was a basket maker and made beautiful baskets. I'd seen strange things. It was part of that world of those older people. And the younger people kind of stayed away from it. She took me under her wing, or I forced myself under her wing. I don't know what, but we established a very good relationship. What she did for me as a troubled youth is something that I always remembered. What I experienced with her, with the stories she told and the things that I saw and witnessed, is that the world that I thought I knew was very small. And there's something huge and great and wondrous beyond me, much bigger than me. You might call it God or nature or the everlasting. What she taught me and the influence that she had on me always reminded me that there was something bigger than me. And her life as a medicine woman was one where there was, in fact, the elimination of the ego, the eradication of the ego. She was a medicine woman. She was there to heal and doctor others. So much of the Western notion of Indian or medicine mystical empowerment is about self-empowerment. But in fact, my experience with the Indian doctors was about a surrender of the ego to the everlasting, to the spirit. I think that that is really what she did for me. She opened a door that made me realize that there is so much more that I can know and that I can think about and that I'm ultimately responsible for.
So when did you first experience a sense of the sacred? And isn't story often the best expression of things held sacred?
I remember, though I didn't think it was sacred as a youth, I remember having spent a lot of time with animals, as I mentioned, be they cows, horses. And I remember then as a child in my dreams at night, all of those birds and animals, all of those things, even the cows, would turn into people. They would be people. As I learned later, a lot of our creation stories talk about a time before this one when all the animals were in fact people. I always remembered that, and I guess it always created in me a kind of empathy, though I couldn't articulate it and didn't have the language for it. So that was one thing, Stefan. The other is, I remember once driving with Mabel, taking her up to see Mrs. Parrish, another Indian doctor, Kashyapomo, great prophet. She wanted me to drive her all the way up the coast, and it was foggy and horrible, and I wanted to turn around, and it was a Friday night, and I'd rather have been with my friends or whatever. I said to her, Mabel, it's really foggy. We shouldn't do this. We should turn around and go back instead of traveling Highway 1 up the coast, which is dangerous without the fog. And then she said, I knew a woman who had a fog song, and I thought to myself, well, old woman, why don't you sing it? And then, of course, she started singing it. And a tunnel opened up in the fog, and we drove 20 miles to the reservation. We got out of the car once we got up to the reservation, and she tapped the hood of the car, and she said, I guess the song still works, don't it? You know, you see things like that, experience things like that, and those are just some of my many senses of the sacred. What stories can do, when you write a story or read a story, it opens your mind to something bigger. And any time, I believe, a door opens and the mind expands, the world itself and all of creation simultaneously expands. So stories get you to think. They catch you off guard. They remind you that you don't know everything and there's more to know. And I think that that's sacred. It's our medicine. Now, we can also use it as bad medicine. A story killed 6 million Jews. Stories cause horrible wars and much of the condition of the world we're in today. But there can also be stories that can show us another way.
I think personally that we have lost our connection to things sacred. How important is it that we regain them?
It is essential that we regain a relationship to nature. Because if we don't have a sense of awe, if we aren't reminded that we're not the center of the universe, if we're not reminded that we're not the one and only thing here, then we are going to continue on the path that we're on, separate from nature and separate from one another. And I agree with what the German philosopher Tillich once said, the original sin is separation. Separation will beget separation, and then fear. Once you're separated from something, fear sets in, and we build higher and higher walls. Walls against nature, walls against one another, walls against neighbors. I think it is more important than ever to reconnect and rethink and undo the kinds of thinking that keeps us separate from one another and the natural world. It's more important now than ever. I want to be able to say, I left you some stories and some alternatives, which is what any older or great elder can do. I left you some stories. I had an old person once say to me, the person who dies with the most stories is the richest person. And I believe that. And good stories, I might say.
So in your latest book, The Forgetters, you introduce us to two sisters, Question Woman and Answer Woman. Together, they talk of the journeys of the forgetters. Who are the forgetters, and what inspired you to write this book?
I had originally written How a Mountain Was Made, kind of retold creation tales from Sonoma Mountain here, which is a sacred mountain where we say Coyote created the earth and the world as we know it. Then, of course, people went out into the world and forgot those important lessons that we must remember about the limits of the ego, how silly we can be when we forget the stories and forget what is important. And as a result, harm or effect we have on nature with everything we do, good or bad. The forgetters are basically all of us. And when you forget that we are in fact connected, there's lessons to be learned. And each of these stories in personal ways tells a story of somebody who has forgotten something or has used their ego or had some tricks up their sleeve and the consequences of those behaviors that are not conducive to life. I wanted to have these two crows, and they need one another. Question woman, she always has questions, and she can't remember anything she's been told before. And answer woman can't, her sister, twin sister, can't remember the stories unless she's asked. So they're themselves dependent on one another to remember and tell the stories and the consequences of their forgetting. As an older person and as a leader of the tribe, I really feel that it's important now to leave these kinds of stories, though they're local here, they're universal. Much of American Indian literature today is about trauma, the consequences of colonization. But I think we need stories that will connect us or reconnect us and undo colonization and undo a colonized mind and get us to begin thinking in bigger and wonderful ways. Some of them, the characters are characters. They all learn certain things because we've forgotten so much of what is important. And it's essential that we remember our connection to things, even if we have to learn sometimes lessons the hard way. And that's what these stories tell.
So can you talk about the symbolism of crows in the book?
We have a lot of crows around here, and crows are very smart birds. They're also, in some ways, very silly. And like Coyote Creator, they're very smart, but then sometimes do silly and kinds of crazy things. So in many ways, they have attributes that human beings have. And crows, they talk a lot, so they're good storytellers. And I saw always these pair of crows down on the fence as I drive down the mountain, and they're always there. And so I kind of heard them talking or thought of them talking, and I thought, they're sitting there telling stories. I better listen. And that's what how they kind of came about. But crows have been around, and in much of American Indian lore, and I don't want to generalize, it's coyote often or crows that become central figures because, like us, they at times think they're smart, and thinking they're smart will get them in trouble when they forget that they are, in fact, just a part of the world and not the center of it.
So as a Native American writer, do you feel a responsibility to others to advance Native literature?
Absolutely. In fact, I've made a career of this. Recently, I interviewed Tommy Orange on his new book. We were talking about, with American Indian literature, there's been several renaissances. First, there was Scott Momaday, then Leslie Marvin Silko, then Louise Erdrich, then myself and Sherman Alexie, and now Tommy Orange. And so I've always just continually surprised by how little American people know about American Indian culture and history. We are the prick in the American conscience, but who are we as people? Who are we here and now? And so I've always felt compelled to tell that story. But also there is the knowledge that indigenous people have that has miraculously survived through our elders, important lessons about life. As I said earlier, I think now more than ever, people need to hear or learn about sustainable living. How do you live with nature instead of against it? Again, the Kashaya Pomo, great medicine woman and prophet, Essie Parrish, in the 1950s, she said in the roundhouse to her people at the Kashaya Reservation, "A day will come when the white people will be coming to us and asking us for answers, how to live with the world, because they know the way they've been living is destroying the world, poisoning the earth. So they're going to come back to us." And she said, "All you young people, all the things that I'm teaching you and the ancestors have been teaching, you're leaving the teachings on the ground like clothes." She says, "Pick them up because they'll be necessary." And the stories that many of us are telling are those stories, picking up those things. The lessons that we can learn from that which survives from our ancient cultures. So all of those things come together are essential for all Americans to know.
I find that nature almost becomes another character in some of your books. How do you find and seek inspiration for that in our natural surroundings?
I think when I see a tree or I see something, beautiful redwood tree, or the flight of a buzzard by my window, or quail over the ground in the spring, I wonder, I start asking questions. I almost start talking. Well, I do start talking to them, I suppose. I start asking questions. I begin a dialogue. I guess the best way to answer your question would be to say, they are living, they're alive, and I am part of them. And that relationship is my ongoing story, my dialogue with them that I'll have my entire life. Mabel once told me a story, and I forget now what it was, but I asked her, "What does a story mean?" And she said to me, "Life will teach you what the story means the way the story teaches you about what life means." It's a dialogue. And with all of life, we need that kind of dialogue. Not being fixed, but ongoing, becoming.
So your writings are connected to the Native American experience with nature. What do you see as the next literary trend for Native American writers?
That's an interesting question. And I think increasingly, even though the trend now is heavily and what's popular and hitting bestseller lists and so forth has a lot to do with trauma, I think increasingly with the climate crisis, what needs to happen are more stories from indigenous peoples, not just American Indians, but indigenous peoples, about how to think differently about the world so that we can act and live differently, and let us even say, create policy that will help us survive or create a sustainable and responsible relationship with all of nature. That's where I hope it goes. That's what I've done in this collection, The Forgetters. I wanted The Forgetters to be something that I could give to the next generation, something that would be eternal in some ways, and not just about me or my personal or even tribal struggles.
So among the many achievements in your life, you are serving your 16th term as the chairman of the Federated Indians of Greaton Rancheria. How has that position of chairman changed you and your perception of our relationship to nature and to the land?
That's a big and kind of tough question. It's certainly been a challenge. So much of what I'm writing about and what we're all struggling with is, how do we find home? How do we become safe? In a very literal and material sense, being a chairman of the tribe is to make sure that they have a roof over their head, insurance, are able to go to school, all of those things. And then the way that so much of that happened is the casino, a huge resort and casino, which I oversee the daily operations. It's been a challenge in so many ways to stay connected and then to take what I'm doing, this huge business, and the politics that I suddenly find myself in, to remind myself of why I'm doing this. I said the only reason I would stick with the idea of a casino would be if it could, first of all, help take care of all our people, but also if it could become a platform for social justice and environmental stewardship. That is, to use money and finances not just for our own good, but for the world around us. Much of that is what's happened, and so it's kind of a model. It has allowed us the opportunity to have influence on environmental policy, to use resources from a business to basically undo and create other businesses and a sustainable world as much as possible. It's been a challenge for me. I'm a dreamer. I'm a person who likes to write and think. But at the same time, I would argue that more than ever, we need political leaders who are poets and thinkers and writers. We need people who can rethink business models so that they might work towards a sustainable and a better future. Too often, our politicians have come up in silos and live in silos. If I have any credibility as a leader, it's that I came up knowing people from the streets and as I grew up, but then as an academic, as a writer, as a thinker, and the values I've had from the elders like Mabel McKay, which influence my leadership and what I feel is important.
Do you think that indigenous cultures from all around the world are beginning to receive the respect they deserve?
Very good question. I don't know about the respect, but I think what we're really talking about here is people around the world are realizing that they need this indigenous knowledge. So I think more than ever, people are seeing the value of what we knew and the way we lived. Europeans thought that we were just lazy. We weren't using the land to make money. We were living with nature instead of against it, and they couldn't understand that. And I think more than ever, science and history is showing us that the Indian relationship and sensibility is one that is going to be necessary and imperative if we are to survive as a species.
What do most indigenous people or cultures, what do they bring to the table in regards to our current climate crisis?
I think what they bring to the table, simply put, Stefan, are blueprints for a reciprocal relationship with the land that helps us understand that we are responsible for the land and responsible for our own survival. Indigenous cultures were always local, of course, and local specific in the ways in which they dealt with things, but they all had something in common, and that is the sense that we are apart and not separate from the world in which we live.
So lastly, how important is story to finding our way forward?
Story is all we have. Language is all we have to communicate with one another. And the stories we tell and the manners in which we tell them are the ways that we can understand and begin to think about our experience in the world. Stories are a textualized version of human experience that has been and at the same time can shape human experience. It tells what has been, what is, and what is possible. And all we have to do that is language. Yes, people will tell you they have hammers and tractors and things like that, but ultimately, before that is the word.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Greg Saris, and that you take the opportunity to read his latest book, The Forgetters. If you would like to learn more about his other books and the work that Greg is doing, please visit his website, greg-saris.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with friends, family, and colleagues. You can follow Nature Revisited on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, or our website, nordenproductions.com. I would also like to invite you to share your comments and ideas, and even suggestions for future guests for Nature Revisited on the comment section of this episode on our website. The music for Nature Revisited is Tim Buckley, Buzzin' Fly. Nature Revisited is produced by Stefan Van Orden and Charles Gagan. And I hope you will join me for the next edition of Nature Revisited. And in the meantime, do not forget, we are nature.